All right, Jim, how are you? This is we're here for episode 5 of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, and you are now in New York.
I am in New York, and we have a guest all the way from the Philippines today.
We do, and it's my good friend Commodore Jay Tarriella, who is the Philippine Coast Guard spokesman for the West Philippine Sea, and this is propitious timing. In the past 24 hours, we've had two Philippine ships water cannoned by the China Coast Guard near Scarborough Shoal. Those ships, as we speak, are still in harm's way. They are distributing food and fuel to Philippine fishing boats about 80 kilometers east of the shoal. And so Jay is generously shoehorning us in between the meeting with the Presidential Communications Office and a press conference. So let's get right into it. Jay, we're going to ask you the obvious question that we ask right off the top. Why should we care if China is harassing Philippine ships?
Well, Ray, the harassment of the Philippine Coast Guard vessel, or whether the Bureau of Fisheries and Aquatic and the ordinary Filipino fishermen, this is not just an harassment on the Philippine government. This actually a mockery to the international law, to the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. That's why it's not just a fight for the Philippines, but it's actually a fight for all like-minded states to go against this aggressive action of China. It is important for all these like-minded states, not just the United States, who is our traditional ally, to help the Philippine government in countering Chinese aggression. Because what is at stake here is the rules-based order. This is already, Chinese government is obviously and blatantly going against the international rules-based order. And that is what is at stake here. If we're going to allow China to be emboldened to just continuously use force to justify their 9-dash line, we're actually giving an opportunity for other countries which say that, the international law no longer matters, that the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea doesn't have teeth. So what if another kind of state like China will be a rising power, would also do the same thing? Our rules-based order is at stake here, Ray. So there's a fight for all of us, not just for the Philippines.
So, Jay, the Chinese line is that this interrupts the good negotiations that you had going on and helping achieve a peaceful resolution of the territorial disagreements. How do you respond to that?
Well, Jim, the Philippine government presently and the previous government, well, let's talk about the previous government. From 2016 to 2022, the former president, President Duterte, has been very close to President Xi Jinping. He has said a lot of good things about President Xi Jinping and the government of China. But in those 6 years, what has happened? The Filipino fishermen are still being harassed. Chinese Coast Guard still harasses the Philippine Coast Guard vessel. Their supply mission of the armed forces of the Philippines still a struggle. So nothing really changed. And the Chinese maritime militia have also been swarming our exclusive economic zone. If you're going to compare what has happened before and now, it's pretty much the same. The only difference is that we are exposing the illegal actions and aggressive behavior of China to the international community. And I think our approach of transparency, of telling the world how bully China is, doesn't really, provoke them. Because in the first place, the escalation of tension in the West Philippine Sea has been happening because of the aggressive action of China, and the Philippines is just on the receiving end.
So, Jay, on this issue of transparency and whether or not it is classified as a provocation, obviously you're hearing from our Chinese friends and some people in Manila that it is actually the Philippines' transparency policy that is the provocation, that things were fine until the Philippines began to show the pictures and the video. Do you think that the transparency policy has been a net positive for the Philippines, or do you think that the risks that the Philippines is running and any sort of possible loss of trade and investment from China is actually outweighing the benefits the Philippines is getting?
Well, first of all, before we talk about the net positive about the trade and the economic aspect of this transparency, I would like to still give credit on this transparency because, President Bongbong Marcos, when he was elected, he has inherited a nation wherein majority of the Filipinos were made to believe that China is no longer aggressive, that China already allows the Filipino fishermen to do fishing in Bajo de Masinloc and in other parts of the West Philippine Sea. This means that the misinformation and the fake news is so much in its magnitude that it's very difficult for President Marcos to unify the Filipino people about what's really happening, to tell about what's the real score in the West Philippine Sea. So with this transparency, you know for a fact, Ray, that the result of the survey for the past so many months have already shown that more Filipinos now are aware of what's happening in the West Philippine Sea. So I think that's the most positive impact of this transparency. The Filipinos now have already awakened from, you know, from that, made themselves believe that China is not an enemy or China was a good friend or something, that kind of narrative. So that's the first one. And then the second one is the international community. After the arbitral award in 2016, Ray, I know that most of the national leaders of the G7 countries and other like-minded states are pretty much disappointed because the former president didn't leverage on the victory of the arbitral award. So right now, for President Bongbong Marcos, with the transparency, more countries now are extending support for the modernization and deepening the security cooperation with the armed force of the Philippines and even the capability building of the Philippine Coast Guard. So these are the gains that we are receiving because of this transparency. And then going to your economic and trade impact, we know for a fact that every time President Bongbong Marcos visits countries who can support our economic and trade, noting for a fact that, you know, going against with China or exposing their aggressive action, they might use economic coercion to punish the Philippines for doing this. But as a result of our transparency, as a result of our deepening security cooperation, more countries are also wanting to invest in the Philippines to support us from that, you know, danger and risk of economic coercion that China would eventually use in the next coming years, as we expect this kind of tension will still go up because we are not, as what the president has mentioned, we're not going to yield, we're not going to surrender a square inch of our territory. We're going to continuously expose the aggressive and illegal actions of the People's Republic of China.
You know, I find it interesting, Jay, that Philippines has been resupplying Sierra Madre, the naval vessel on the shoal, for years. But now that you are making it transparent and taking pictures of the harassment, that's a provocation. It's just a big change in Philippine action to shed light on what's happening, and the Chinese call it provocation. But this is part of the propaganda, not in that way, but calling Ray a tool of the U.S. naval research is the most amazing thing. They would never fund an Air Force guy. First of all. And second of all, that somehow you work for Ray, or you take orders from Ray. I worked with Ray. No one took orders from him, even his staff. That's crazy.
Yeah, what do you think of that, Jay? I mean, we get people in Manila and people even in Beijing who come out and say that I'm somehow the mastermind of some secret plot and that I am the one moving the Jay Terriella pawn around the chessboard to, you know, executing a $500 million propaganda campaign. How do you respond to all of this stuff? I mean, you get it constantly, don't you?
Well, you know, Ray, I've always been asked how I respond with this kind of fake news and trolls in the social media. I would always say that if I'm going to click a social media troll, and I know for a fact that it's just a troll, meaning, you know, it's a soulless entity. It doesn't really exist. He's just a troll. So for me, I have already counted them, like based on our analysis, more than 9,000 trolls now are attacking me on different social media platforms. So for this kind of trolls, I'm happy because I have given them an opportunity of employment. I know that the Chinese are paying them to do that. And we also need to thank the People's Republic of China for foreign direct investment, because they are really putting their money where their mouth is, right? But the second type of the trolls that somehow annoys me or agitates me are those people who are who have real identity. We used to be officials of the government. We used to be smart when they were statesmen. And then eventually becoming a troll, writing a column in their newspaper or posting a social media post that would... I cannot really understand how those kind of people who used to be rational, who used to be patriotic, are now becoming more of a Chinese troll and amplifying and re-echoing what the fake news and misinformation narrative of China has been used.
You know, for Americans, it's important to remember that the Philippines are our ally since 1942, when our soldiers fought side by side, and that we're still allies, right? One of the few allies in the region. And I guess the question for the Philippine government is, how do we use this alliance to push back? So after the tripartite meeting between Presidents Marcos and Biden and Prime Minister Kishida, where do you think this goes next in the forum in the alliance? What happens now?
Well, I think that I usually get that kind of question. Is what is your page two of transparency, Commodore J? This has been asked to me by international media and some of ambassadors here in the Philippines. I would always say, honestly, I don't have page two. I don't have page three of what we do in transparency. Our page one started because of our transparency. We're a small country. We tell the world, we made a story about exposing illegal actions of China. The page two is on you. The page two is on those people who value the rules-based order. The page two is for those louder voices that can tell China to align and adhere to the international law. So if you're going to ask me what's next after doing this transparency, I believe that the Philippine government has done a responsibility to the world, not just for our own country, that what is being attacked here is the rules-based order. The next step now of the story, the next pages of what will happen next, will be put on the shoulders of the G7 countries, of those countries who value the rules-based order, of those countries who understand the international law. If we're going to allow China to, as I said, go on violating different types of international convention at sea and choose to undermine the UNCLOS, this is something that has, the G7 countries must stand up and write the page two and the successive pages of the story.
I noticed you mentioned the G7, but you didn't mention ASEAN. And of course, there has been a negotiation for many years to create a code of conduct between ASEAN and China so that these kinds of things presumably wouldn't happen under a code of conduct. Is there going to be a code of conduct?
Well, Ray, if you're going to ask me, I would approve it now, the code of conduct for today. But that is something that is not to be decided, not just by the Philippine government, not just by the Department of Foreign Affairs. It has to be decided by all ASEAN parties and even the People's Republic of China. So I don't even, code of conduct has been discussed a lot of times, a lot of years already, for a very long time. But until now, it hasn't really moving, and I don't know. But if you're going to ask me now, how do I see ASEAN, the regional countries, the neighboring countries? I believe we're still going to continue the page one of our transparency. People are saying that the reason why ASEAN, particularly the claimant states, whether it's Malaysia or Vietnam, choosing not to say anything about the resupply mission in Ayung Inchol because it's a military operation. And of course, if they're going to say something, it would also undermine their own claim in the South China Sea. Understandably, that would be a fair excuse, right? Even for the Chinese maritime militia swarming in Union Bank, that can also be a fair excuse that Vietnam and Malaysia are not going to support us in criticizing China in their swarming of Chinese maritime militia. Because in Union Back, there's also an overlap between those areas occupied by Vietnam. But when we talk about the welfare of the Filipino fishermen, when we talk about the damage to the marine environment, we believe that these two narratives go across territorial boundaries of the Philippines, Vietnam, or even the entire Southeast Asian region. The welfare of the fishermen of the Filipinos also represent the welfare of the Vietnamese fishermen, Malaysian, and even Indonesian, and even Brunei. If our Filipino fishermen can still be harassed by the Chinese Coast Guard, and I know for a fact that the Malaysian fishermen are also experiencing the same in Lucuna Shoal, and even the Indonesian fishermen in Natuna area, these are already an eye-opener for this government, for them to realize that it's about time for you to expose as well the Chinese Coast Guard harassment of your own fishermen. Otherwise, your own nationalities, your own citizens would say and expose them at their own risk. You know, you can see, I know, Ray, you've seen the Malaysian fishermen posted in social media showing the Chinese Coast Guard are also, you know, shadowing them in their own exclusive economic zone in Lucuna Shoal. This is actually going against the statement of Prime Minister Anwar when he said that they don't have problem with the Chinese Coast Guard. But this Malaysian fishermen now are exposing it to the world that that's not true. Chinese Coast Guard remains to be a problem for the Malaysian fishermen because they are also reaching our own waters. And this is what we intend to do. This kind of transparency will still be, you know, continuously done by the Philippine government, obviously exposing Chinese aggressive action against the Filipino fishermen, and the same thing with the damage to marine environment. Our damage, that the Chinese People's Republic of China's damage to the South China Sea coral reef, according to some study, would take like more than 3 or 5 decades, half a century, for us to be able to grow those giant clams that were destroyed and taken away for either to support the reclamation activities or the Chinese fishermen's activity. So these are issues that has to be exposed for our Southeast Asian neighbors to realize that this kind of activities of China does not just impact the Philippine government, but even their own people.
How's the cooperation? I'm sorry, Ray. How's the cooperation between your Coast Guard and the Coast Guards of neighboring countries?
Well, Jim, we have what we call the ASEAN Coast Guard Forum. As a matter of fact, the ASEAN Coast Guard Forum is currently being discussed in Indonesia right now. Actually, it's ongoing. The Philippine Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Von Hildebrand personally made sure that he'll be in attendance to deepen our Coast Guard cooperation among ASEAN neighbors.
So, Jay, I know you've got a room full of reporters that you have to get to. So just going to give, you know, just sort of one last shot for you. What is it that the rest of the world should be learning from the Philippines experience right now in the West Philippine Sea?
Thank you, Ray. I think the biggest contribution of the Philippine government in understanding China is that, you know, the Chinese government has always been, has a lot of own ways to innovate and deceive the international community. That's why maritime security scholars, whenever they describe China's actions in the South China Sea, most of them, they would call it gray zone tactics, gray zone strategy, maritime gray area. It's because nobody among Southeast Asian countries are telling this or describing this as what particular action does China is doing for them to justify the reclamation of islands, for them to justify the deployment of their Chinese maritime militia and the Chinese Coast Guard harassment for them. It's just ordinary law enforcement operation. These are all in the gray area before we started the transparency. Because right now, the biggest contribution of the Philippine government in policymaking, also in academic, in understanding China, is that we are calling this as illegal actions, outright unlawful. For us, this is not a gray zone activity. This is not a gray zone strategy. This is a violation of the international law. Outrightly, this is just a violation of law. And they are law offenders, and they should be held accountable.
Jay Terriella, my friend, the Philippines' leading voice on the West Philippine Sea in so many ways. I want to thank you for your time. So valuable today when I know you've got so much going on. I want you to just, you know, keep up the fight and keep your chin up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, that was fascinating working with Jay and hearing what he had to say. And that he took the time between briefing the Presidential Communications Board and then running off to a press conference. He took the time to talk to us was excellent. But as a result, we were a little bit rushed. And perhaps, Ray, you can talk a little bit about your work shedding transparency on Chinese activities in the region and why that has resulted in Chinese media attacking you and attacking Jay as being your pawn somehow.
Yeah, Jim, that's really, it's a fascinating story. And, you know, Sea Light, which is the organization from the Gordian Knot Center for National Security Innovation at Stanford that I run, got its start last year at the beginning of the year. And as we began to put our reports on Chinese ship movements and, you know, potential harassment in the South China Sea, the Philippines sort of jumped in and started releasing pictures and video and all of these things. And somehow my name and their effort got sort of all mixed together. And I think it made a very convenient narrative for China to be able to say, look, this is this American guy who actually is sort of controlling everything. And so, you know, Jay has to deal all the time with this accusation. And actually, the Philippines has to deal all the time with this accusation that somehow this is all this big American plot. I mean, I've been accused of as I mentioned in my discussion with Jay, of having a big propaganda budget, that I'm part of the military industrial complex, that I'm a CIA agent, I've got naval intelligence, all kinds of things. And, you know, the remarkable thing, of course, is that Sea Light is an all volunteer organization. Not that we wouldn't like to have $500 million, but we actually just run off of volunteer energy. And so, you know, this thing, of course, ultimately, I think it's just China has seized on the narrative to be able to say this is a convenient way for them to sort of unpack this thing and say, there's no way the Philippines would be doing this if there weren't some secret American hand behind the curtain. But really what's true is that their government has taken this bold step and they've gone way out on a limb. I mean, as we implied in the conversation, other countries aren't doing this. And I'm not sure that any other country has done this with the focus and the effort and the persistence that the Philippines has.
Yeah, I think this is a result of a couple of things. One is, Philippine interests are so frequently under attack by Chinese aggressive activity. Second, it's a little bit, frankly, condescending that they imply that the Philippines couldn't come up with this unless an American told them to.
Yeah.
If I was Filipino, yeah, I'd be a little insulted by that.
Absolutely.
And the third thing, of course, is, well, the Philippines are U.S. allies, so maybe they do feel a little more confident being forward-leaning than some of the other countries in the region.
Well, I mean, you hear it in the... So, you know, I read Chinese propaganda, so you don't have to. I mean, you hear it in their propaganda. They strenuously opposed any groupings of nations or any blocs being formed, especially any outside powers, you know, that anyone who's outside of the family that is around, because, of course, that is where the Philippines, you know, gain their additional strength. They're a smaller country facing down a larger country that is aggressively trying to push into their space and, you know, sort of acquire their maritime rights. And their strength lies in their relationships. If the Philippines if China looks across and sees a small country, they see a country that they can dominate. But if they see a small country networked in together with other countries, some of them even larger and, you know, up to the size of the United States, that is a much more complicated problem for China to try to solve. And it is entirely in the Philippines' interest to sort of make that the case. But, you know, what they get in, you know, what they get, of course, is China will tell you what they are afraid of. And what they're afraid of is the Philippines creating this this network of allies and partners. And the amazing thing is that it's China's own actions that have been generating exactly what China doesn't want.
Well, it's always very interesting. What the Philippines is doing is generating transparency. Here are pictures of what China is doing. And China says, that's a provocation to show the world what we're doing.
Right.
Pretty interesting. The other thing we mentioned in the talk was the code of conduct. And that's sort of a term of art. And that's ASEAN and China have been negotiating since, I think, 2010 on how to treat each other in the South China Sea, as far as claims and where ships can go and all that sort of thing. And China clearly is just dragging out the negotiations as long as possible. ASEAN works by consensus. All the members have to agree. And some of the members are frankly enthralled to China. So they will never let anything go through that doesn't meet with Chinese approval. So for the Philippines to wait for this code of conduct to be completed is a sucker's game.
Absolutely. And in the end, the interests are just too divergent. Why is there a code of conduct being created in the first place? They already had something that they called the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the South China Sea that they all signed in 2002. China signed it, all the ASEAN nations signed it, and it laid out a whole bunch of things like, you know, we will, there will not be, the disputes will be resolved by peaceful means, and there won't be these, all of these things were sort of put out there, and China systematically violated most of them. And so what came out was, well, now we need to have an enforceable version of this. And so the idea is, we basically, you know, the Declaration on the Conduct of the Parties in the South China Sea, or the DOC, basically didn't work because nobody could enforce it. Well, who's going to enforce the code of conduct, right? I mean, China's not going to accept it if anyone except for China is the enforcer, right? And of course, if you're an ASEAN country, you can't let that happen. So ultimately, it is a place to have discussion, but I am very much a pessimist that there will ever be a product, because ultimately, how do you build something like that on a foundation of bad faith?
Well, I've always wished that ASEAN within ASEAN would agree with their own code of conduct and present it to China and say, here's what we've all agreed to, sign or don't sign.
Well, and you already indicated the problem with that, Jim, is that there are ASEAN countries whose interests, you know, that don't see it in their own interest to sort of come along and agree with that. I mean, if you're Laos or Cambodia and you're not already on the South China Sea, and you know, Cambodia's got a basically a Chinese naval base that's taken form on its southern coast, and they're, you know, Laos has a Chinese train that's being built through its territory, and you know, there's nothing in it for them if they were to go along with an ASEAN only deal. Now, I know that some people have suggested maybe, you know, try to do that at the same time as you're doing some agreements on the Mekong River where they do have interests. But boy, that seems like a bank shot and a long shot. So I just don't know how it gets done, Jim.
Well, this is why we're no longer in government.
All right, Jim. Well, let's. Why don't we move on to There I Was, and I think it's my turn.
It is your turn. Where were you?
Well, so let's go all the way back to the beginning of my 35-year military career, when I was actually stationed in the Philippines. I was at Clark Air Base, which was the major U.S. air base. Of course, it was in service all through the Vietnam War, saw lots and lots of activity then. And then by the time I got there, it was right after the Philippines had its big people power revolution and the first president, Marcos, had been deposed. And so we were there. And after I got married in the Philippines in 1990. And right after that, we began to hear these rumors about some volcanic activity. Now, if you're ever standing at what is Clark Air Base now, you can look out and see this huge mountain on, you know, one side of the base, and it was Mount Ararat. And if you look at it, it kind of looks like a volcano is supposed to look. But that was not the activity that anybody was talking. There was no activity in Mount Ararat. It was actually on the other side, and there's a sort of nondescript mountain range. And right in the middle of this mountain range was this nondescript mountain called Mount Pinatubo. And all of a sudden, volcanologists start appearing from Manila and other places in the world. And everybody's like, there's this big stir about a volcano. And, you know, if you've never like been up close around a volcano, you don't know that you should actually be really alarmed when these things happen. And they were really alarmed. And so all of a sudden we get to, you know, in 1991, about June of 1991, they tell us, everybody, that we have to get out. Essentially, everybody's going to get in their cars and drive from Clark Air Base to Subic Naval Base in a single day. And so we all get into our cars in the morning, and we sort of leave, and they've got this, you know, couple tens of thousands of people driving from one base to another base in a single day. It took all day long. There were helicopters flying overhead. There were security people all along the route to keep us safe and all of these things. And we got to Subic, and then they had to figure out what to do with all of us. And so we get there, and we all end up staying with various families. And on a particular day, my wife and I are staying with this family, this Navy family that takes us in, and they decide we've got to put these people to work doing something. And so it's my turn to go down to the Sampa Gita Club and on behalf of my unit to sit at a folding table with a beige telephone, a green logbook, and a recall roster. And I am the control center for our squadron for 4 hours. That's my job. I'm supposed to go there for 4 hours. As I'm driving down, I can actually see the ash cloud forming. And because it's the Philippines, we can't just have a volcano. We also have to have a typhoon at the same time, because that's the way it was in the Philippines. And so the first ash begins to come down wet on my windshield. And when I turn on my wipers, it smears across the windshield. And so I get to the Sampa Gita Club, and I go in, and I'm replacing the guy who was there for the 4 hour shift in front of me. And he jumps up and says, "Thank God," and runs out the door. And that began the longest night of my life, because it turned pitch dark. And in the middle of the afternoon, the rain was coming down, clogged with ash. So everything was coming down wet. There was constant seismic activity. So there were earthquakes all the time. The ash in the air was causing, and with the typhoon, was causing lightning strikes. And we began to hear around the area that there were roofs that were collapsing because this wet ash was coming in and just building up on these roofs. And guess what? We were sitting in the Sampa Gita Club, which was this large flat roof building. So at a certain point in time, whoever was in charge down there, it sure wasn't me, I was a junior enlisted airman, says, "We've got to send people up to the roof to shovel the roof to make sure the roof doesn't collapse." So we trudge out into the ash storm, and we get shovels, ladders, surgical masks to keep from breathing in the ash, which didn't actually make a difference because it was wet. Goggles, which only actually served to get caked up with ash, with wet ash, so we had to use those more as visors, and flashlights. And so we'd stand up there, and one person would hold out some flashlights, and a couple other people would shovel the roof. And at a certain point, you're shoveling the roof of a building, you're swinging a metal object in the middle of a lightning storm, with constant earthquakes, contemplating your mortality. Right? We managed to get through that night. I remember seeing the sun come up the next day, and it was like the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. But they ended up having to bring in the fleet in order to get us all out of there, because there was no way to evacuate everyone out of the Philippines by air because of this volcano. So my wife's first trip to the United States in her whole life, actually her first trip out of the Philippines, started on the USS Roanoke, where we went out of Subic Bay and down to Cebu, and eventually we got back to the West Coast, and she met my family at my brother's wedding, which happened to be on the exact same day we got back to California. So she met my entire family as a refugee on this auspicious day. We had to stop at Sears to get me a few extra pieces of clothes so I could be suitable to be seen at a wedding. So there I was. I swear, I just left like 15 things out of this story. One of the most surreal experiences of my entire life.
Ray, it's all downhill from there.
And our marriage has survived three decades since because it was built on a foundation of ash.
All right.
All right. Until next time, Jim. And of course, for our listeners, we invite you to keep listening to our podcast. If you have that streaming service, if you have Apple Podcasts, if you have Spotify or whatever you have, please subscribe. We've got a lot of really good episodes coming up. And of course, you know, we certainly value your five-star reviews and your good comments. And for Ray, for Jim, this is Ray. We'll see you next time.
Bye all.